Today is Wednesday, December 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, mourners wait for hours in the cold outside the U.S. Capitol to pay their final respects to a former president. Some top U.S. senators say they're convinced the Saudi crown prince ordered the killing of a Washington Post contributor.
I would really question somebody's judgment if they couldn't figure this out. It is there to be figured out.
A major UN conference in Poland is underway to solidify plans laid out in the Paris Climate Accord. Also ahead, American women are changing the face of funerals in the United States. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, streams of mourners filed past the flag-draped casket of former U.S. President George H.W. Bush in the U.S. Capitol Tuesday, a day ahead of the state funeral for the country's 41st president. Mark Rozelle is dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Virginia and the author of the book Power and Prudence, The Presidency of George H.W. Bush. He tells International Edition's Sarah Williams that the late president was a transitional figure between Presidents Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton.
In many ways, Bush was a transitional figure. He was the last of a generation that, of course, was out of World War II. He was a fighter pilot there. Bill Clinton represented a new emerging trend in American politics that was very different from really the older generation that George H.W. Bush represented. And also, he was quite a contrast in style. Ronald Reagan, of course, very charismatic leader, able to give the great speech. George H.W. Bush recognized he simply could not be Reagan. He tried to tamp down expectations for charismatic leadership and big, bold gestures coming out of the White House, and to present a much more modest, I think, you know, consolidating style of leadership rather than bold gestures and major new initiatives. And I don't think he was appreciated in his time exactly because there was not a lot of flash, a lot of theatrics coming out of his administration, and because of his really very low-key style. But that ultimately didn't sit well with many Americans in the 1992 election. They wanted something different, and many saw that Bill Clinton represented more of the future and George H.W. Bush represented the past.
Well, and I suppose also during that campaign, Bush was portrayed as an elite person because of his family background, his education at Yale, and he was perhaps viewed as out of touch. I remember those pictures of him at a grocery store at a scanner, and he looked like he was kind of amazed by it.
Yes, yeah. The grocery scanner story really hit home for a lot of people because that represented, in many ways, a president who was out of touch with ordinary Americans. So the Democrats made fun of him, saying that he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth and that he had been, you know, driven in a limousine to kindergarten and so forth. I mean, all of this was exaggerated, but the point was that he came from a patrician background, very privileged, and during a very heated recession that created a great deal of economic anxiety in the country, many people saw George H.W. Bush as simply not being in touch with the suffering of ordinary Americans, not really having a clue what to do about the domestic economy. And that's what created the opening politically for Bill Clinton. Now, I would give George H.W. Bush a lot of credit in the sense that he accepted a budget compromise that he knew was politically unpopular. It had the tax increase in it that he said he would never do. And he also, during the campaign, refused advice from his political advisors to create a government stimulus to the economy to give it an immediate shock and give people some hope that he was in control of the economy, could do something about it. He believed it was the worst thing we could do. We saw the recovery happen after his defeat. I think he took the responsible position from a policy standpoint, but from a political one, I think it ultimately hurt him.
He was president also at a very key time at the end of the Cold War when the Berlin Wall fell, and he has been, perhaps retroactively, very much praised for his conduct during that time.
He is praised today for his conduct during the massive transitions that took place in the international environment while he was president, particularly the breakup of the old Soviet Union. But interestingly, in his time, he took a lot of criticism for not bragging about we won the Cold War, for not doing a big public dance showing off that the United States had prevailed in the long Cold War. He was an old-style politician with a diplomatic background who, you know, believed in a sort of low-key style and personal relationships and not bragging, not making a big show. And interestingly, many people in his time saw that as a kind of lack of leadership coming from him. They had been used to, I think, a much more publicly overt, theatrical style of leadership from his predecessor, Ronald Reagan. And a lot of his contemporaries wonder, why is George Bush being so quiet during such a profound change in the world's history? And it just didn't suit his style. He had a different way of proceeding. And ultimately, I think many people thought that the president should have been a little bit more out there in a very public, visible way, showcasing his accomplishments and the role he played in those transitions.
That's Mark Rosell, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Virginia, and the author of the book Power and Prudence, The Presidency of George H.W. Bush. Well, after a briefing by Gina Haspel, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, on the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi Tuesday, U.S. senators said there is no doubt in their minds that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS, was directly involved in the killing. Tuesday's briefing took place after the CIA was excluded last week when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Defense Secretary James Mattis spoke with senators about the journalist's killing. Mattis said there is no smoking gun. Pompeo told lawmakers there's no direct evidence of a connection between the Crown Prince and the killing. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who had been adamant about receiving the CIA briefing, said he has no doubt MBS is complicit with the murder of Khashoggi and the U.S. needs to react appropriately.
There's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw. You have to be willfully blind not to come to the conclusion that this was orchestrated and organized by people under the command of MBS.
Khashoggi, a U.S.-based Washington Post contributor who was a strong critic of the Crown Prince, was murdered October 2nd inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Graham says he will not support arms sales to Saudi Arabia as long as MBS is leading the country.
So I'm going to try to get a sense of the Senate resolution where we all vote and designate MBS as one of the people responsible for the death of Mr. Khashoggi, that he was complicit in the murder, that I not only have high confidence, overwhelming belief that that's the case, then what do you do about it? I want to make sure that Saudi Arabia is put on notice, that business as usual has come to an end for me. I will not look at the kingdom the same way that I used to look at it. I will not support arms sales until all responsible for the death of Mr. Khashoggi have been brought to justice. I will no longer support the war in Yemen as constructed.
Meanwhile, Sweden's foreign minister confirmed late Tuesday that the parties to the Yemen conflict have begun to arrive in Sweden for peace talks that are expected to start later this week. UN Yemen envoy Martin Griffiths has been conducting intensive rounds of shuttle diplomacy to meet with all sides for serious negotiations in a bid to wind down the brutal war that has killed tens of thousands, collapsed the economy, and left millions on the brink of starvation. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke about the latest developments with Anthony Billingsley, senior lecturer of Middle East politics at the University of South Wales in Australia, and asked if he thinks this will actually make a difference and take hold.
It means that some sort of progress could be made, although I'm pretty skeptical about any sort of significant or major progress on this.
The U.S. issued a statement on Tuesday suggesting that this is a good sign. They wish the parties well, but they also warned that it will not be an easy or quick process.
That's absolutely correct. It is such a mess in Yemen. Not only do you have the Houthi confronting the Saudis et al., but within the Saudi coalition you have divisions. There's a very large problem that's built up over years in the south of the country with the Emiratis attempting to control that part of the conflict and that part of the country without any sort of liaison with the Saudis. So you might be able to focus your attention on Sana'a and on Hodeidah, which are further north from where the Emirati embroglio is in effect. But you know that area then is going to be probably outside any progress.
Who holds the upper hand as these talks get underway, perhaps this week?
It is interesting. The Khashoggi statements by various U.S. senators and the CIA, etc., could well mean that the Saudis are feeling under, and the U.S. decision not to refuel Saudi aircraft in the air may apply considerable pressure to the Saudis to be more compliant than they have, more conciliatory than they have been in the past. So there may have been a reasonably subtle change in the balance as a result of that incident.
You were talking about differences earlier, and you referred to the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi October 2nd. That prompted some European countries to suspend arms exports to Saudi Arabia. Does that add a new element to this bid to end this conflict?
Well, I think it does. I think it's, the Germans were the most forthright and the first to come out with any embargo, but they're relatively insignificant. The significant ones are the Brits and the Americans. Khashoggi thing, I think, is working some sort of impact both on the U.S. And Britain in terms of their attitude to what the Saudis are doing in Yemen.
The UN warned Tuesday of a severe increase in Yemen's hunger rate and cautioned the situation will deteriorate further in the new year. Is this another pressure point to wind down this conflict?
You're right. I mean, we're talking now about something like 8 million people being fed by the UN each month, and that's going to increase to 12 million a month next year, is forecast. The question, I suppose, is whether the Saudis, I don't think the Saudis themselves are particularly concerned about the number of people who are starving to death. I don't think that's something that they would feel would influence their military tactics. I mean, we've seen them attacking civilian targets almost since the war began. But I think it's probably going to add to outside pressure on the Saudis and the Emiratis to allow significant amounts of aid, perhaps the opening of Sana'a Airport, perhaps the UN control of Hodeidah, both of which are major sources for aid to get into the country.
That's Anthony Billingsley, senior lecturer in Middle East politics at the University of South Wales. Special counsel Robert Mueller, who was overseeing the investigation into Russia's meddling into the 2016 election and whether the Trump campaign was involved in that meddling, has released his first major report. Mueller filed the sentencing memo for former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and asked for no prison time, citing substantial assistance. Joining us now to talk more about it is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. A lot of the report is actually blacked out due to the ongoing investigation, so we don't know a whole lot, but what does this tell you about how big of a deal it is so far?
It's a very big deal. When you look at what's been going on with Paul Manafort, when you look at what's been going on with some of the other witnesses that have been out there, you realize that when you are saying, no, you shouldn't do a day, that really says something about what Michael Flynn has provided to the special counsel and potentially what that could mean for the president.
The version that was released has a lot redacted, lots of things we can't see because apparently it's an ongoing investigation, lots of things blacked out. The core of his cooperation is blacked out. What he told Mueller is blacked out. So a lot is still a mystery. Pages and pages of blacked out material. Why? What's happening here?
That's very purposeful. The Mueller team is specifically trying to keep as much information as close to the vest as they can because what they're starting to look at is others that they can indict. A big purpose here is not just about what's going on. If there is classified information, that may be one piece, but I don't think that's it. This is about going after others who may be in the crosshairs up this proverbial chain.
It also said that he cooperated in multiple investigations, including a criminal investigation with the name of whoever it is that's under criminal investigation redacted as well, blacked out. So I would imagine that would be worrisome to the Trump administration.
Well, it should be, because what we're seeing is that Michael Flynn worked very closely with the Trump camp as they were moving into the election itself. And so he worked very closely with his son-in-law. He worked very closely with his son. He worked very closely with others in the team as they prepared for the election. So the fact that they're saying there is a criminal investigation, and in fact, multiple investigations, really shows the extent to which Michael Flynn actually had access to information. I think that is what is most troubling to people who actually may be of interest to the special counsel.
Were you surprised that Mr. Flynn got no jail time?
Actually, I'm not. And I'm not because what we have seen since pretty early on is that Michael Flynn really started to work with the team itself. There were questions about what he could provide, but I think what he was pretty clear about is that when he said he was going to cooperate, he did. I think there's some other reasons, too. You look at his long service, his long military service, mm-hmm. and I think that says something about who he is. I recognize that it has not necessarily anything to do with the criminal indictments
right.
or about his cooperation, but it does say something about sort of his general overall character, and I think the Mueller team would take that into consideration as well.
Does this give any indication to you how much longer this investigation will go on? Is it wrapping up or do we still have a little ways to go?
Well, I guess you never know because as they continue to dig, it all depends on what they're going to find. And yet at the same time, if you look at what they're doing now, if you think of it in the context of sort of a circle, that circle is spinning tighter and tighter and tighter. And what we have seen is a closer and closer effort to get to the Oval Office itself, or at least to the senior advisors of the Trump team. And it seems to me that's where we're going. There aren't that many of them left. So my expectation is that we are getting closer to done. Does that mean we're done? I guess we'll wait and see.
All right, former Central Intelligence Officer, agency officer, and current criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Congo's worst Ebola outbreak hits the women especially hard. Families of local IS members face rejection in Iraq. Sudan lawmakers back an amendment to let Bashir stand again. Tensions soar in the Balkans over plans for Kosovo army. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, now that the U.S. and China have reached a 90-day truce in their trade war, questions remain about whether the world's two largest economies will be able to achieve a more extensive and definitive deal. President Donald Trump is signaling caution on his trade truce. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
The president's called the deal he reached with his Chinese counterpart a breakthrough, but details on just what they agreed on have been limited. This morning, the president says his team's working to see if a real deal is doable. He says one probably will happen, but tweets, "If not, remember, I am a tariff man," saying tariffs will always be the best way to max out our economic power. The president says negotiations will last 90 days. Many economists doubt Washington and Beijing can achieve much on such a big issue in just 3 months. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Meanwhile, stocks globally sank and the dollar fell Tuesday as optimism that the U.S. and China would quickly resolve the trade dispute dwindled. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell over 700 points. That's nearly 3%. The S&P 500 lost 76 and the NASDAQ Composite dropped nearly 240 points. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Thank you.
VOA's International Edition continues. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is warning the world is in deep trouble with regard to climate change. Speaking Monday at the opening of 2 weeks of climate talks in Poland, Guterres made a dramatic appeal to world leaders. He called for a major reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and implored the world and world leaders to take more seriously the threat of global warming and to act quickly.
Even as we witness devastating climate impacts causing havoc across the world, we are still not doing enough, nor moving fast enough, to prevent irreversible and catastrophic climate disruption.
Well, signatories to the landmark 2015 Paris Accord pledged to cut greenhouse gas emissions and limit the rise in global temperatures to less than 2 degrees Celsius. By 2030, President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement because of what he says is the economic damage the treaty's provisions would cause. Joining us now is Dr. Andrew Light, senior fellow at the World Resources Institute and former senior climate change advisor at the U.S. State Department. So far, we have heard opening remarks at the summit that paint a pretty dire picture.
I definitely think that climate change is one of the biggest challenges that humanity has ever faced. And maybe one difference between it and, you know, some of the world wars that have been fought is that there was never any question that those were urgent problems that needed to be addressed immediately. Those were urgent threats that needed to be addressed immediately. And there was no major power in the world that was doubting the reality of the problem. But yet the world's second largest emitter and the most powerful country on the planet, the United States, has a president that doubts the reality of the threat.
And that's certainly alarming to many Americans. It's certainly alarming to many people around the world. In contrast to what we're hearing in the United States from the leader of the United States, how progress can this summit make without the United States playing an active role?
Well, I think they can still make progress. The thing that you need to keep in mind about these meetings is that there's over 190 parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. All of them basically have a veto, so they have to. It operates by consensus. That's why it took over 20 years to get a workable climate change agreement. We have that in place, and really the point of this meeting is to finish a lot of the technical work that we started doing in Paris in 2015 and that is needed to make sure that this is a workable and endurable regime so that we can reliably understand what countries are committing to do to reduce their emissions. We can have a high degree of transparency to see if they are, in fact, achieving their goals, and we have several mechanisms that are designed to ratchet up their ambition over time. Immediately, there's not much that the U.S., I think, will do or can do to derail this particular meeting. But looking forward, my worry would be that if the United States is committed to finally formally withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, which the first time that they can do that would be in 2020, then this could have, over time, an effect of potentially encouraging those who are opposed to climate action in other countries of getting bolder about their opposition.
If it's true that time really is running out, and we're already seeing many of the impacts, how worried should we be about the natural world that it can survive even if some sort of agreement is made? Will it actually happen?
I think that countries are doing something. I think there's a lot of activity. Even in the United States at the non-federal level, there's a lot of activity. Does there need to be more? Absolutely. But the important thing is that the Paris Agreement is still solid. There is no other country in the world that has announced any intention of leaving the Paris Agreement. Just this past weekend at the G20, the other 19 countries other than the United States said that the Paris Agreement was irreversible. And I do think that it is the kind of agreement that can eventually get us towards the temperature stabilization targets that we've articulated. But it is one of those things where, yes, I think that anything that can be done to increase the ambition of different countries has to be done. And any country that's pulling out or recalcitrant like the United States is right now, then there need to be consequences for that.
Do you agree with Attenborough that if we don't take action, that literally we could see the extinction of much of the natural world?
Yes, though I don't think that we're going to wind up being in that dire a position by the end of this century. I think that we are risking quite a lot. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the world's premier body of climate scientists who do these giant assessment reports, just released a report about a month and a half ago, laying out, for example, the difference between an increase in global temperature of 1.5 degrees Celsius over a pre-industrial period versus a 2-degree mm-hmm. increase. And though that wouldn't be a whole lot more than we have now, the consequences are pretty dire just of that. That the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius is potentially a difference between a world that has coral reefs and one that does not. I do think that we can still succeed in turning the tide on this. And I believe that we've got a lot of powerful forces, including markets around the world that are breathing, you know, new life into the clean energy economy around the world. Countries are starting to see this as an enormous investment opportunity. And so there's a lot of good indicators as well.
We can't really turn it around, but we could stop it from getting worse.
I think it's going to get worse because this is sort of part of how the atmosphere and ocean and system deals with a long-lived warming agent like carbon dioxide. We've put so much of this pollution into the atmosphere that we're definitely going to be warming more. Could we, though, however, try to achieve our overall climate stabilization goals? I would say yes. And it is not the time to be, you know, throwing up our hands and imagining that nothing can be done, because really we've made a huge, huge step forward with the creation of the Paris Agreement, and I think that it can be a foundation that can get us where we need to be by the end of the century. But we cannot afford, for example, to have powerful countries like the United States sitting on the sidelines for four or more years.
If President Trump does not get reelected in 2 years, and we have a president that comes in and wants to be very engaged and get back in the Paris Climate Accord, yeah. Would that still be something that's possible?
Yes. In fact, the first day that the U.S. can formally pull out of the Paris Agreement, because of the way the agreement is structured, is the day after the 2020 election. So you could have a new president get inaugurated in January and immediately make a decision to rejoin the agreement.
All right, that's Dr. Andrew Light, senior fellow at the World Resources Institute and former senior climate change advisor at the U.S. State Department. 40 years ago, less than 5% of funeral homes in the United States were owned by women, according to the New York Funeral Home Directors. But today, that number is now around 43% and rising. VOA's Kevin Enix has the story.
This group of students at a New York Funeral Services Academy reflect the changing face of the industry. Most of them are women.
Everybody asks me, they're like, oh, you like dead bodies? Nobody likes dead bodies, you know? But it's really, I'm here to help people.
The students say the influx of women will make the industry better.
You cannot never understand how a person truly feels, but you can always let them know that you're there, and that if they need someone to go through it with them, you're there. Where men, they get the job done. And that sounds cruel, but that's just my observation.
At this New York campus, students learn the ins and outs of the industry, including skills like making funeral masks that morticians can use to rebuild faces damaged by disease or trauma. 65% of graduates from funeral services programs are now women. But change is slow to come. 74% of all funeral homes are still run by men. And women who do run funeral homes say some people are still hesitant to work with them.
I did have a family come in and say they didn't want any female funeral directors at running their funeral. And, you know, you can respect those wishes, and that's fine, and I understand that's how the older generation was.
But some, like Professor David Penipent, say funeral home owners must change with the times if they are to survive.
If this profession's going to survive, we as a profession need to embrace women in this profession. Because if we don't embrace women in this profession, the next generation that takes over the profession is not going to be there. And as a result of that, the profession within itself will collapse.
Another example of how women are changing the face and tenor of industries worldwide. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.